Tonight on Arena, Polly Sampson brings us to the Greek island of Hydra with Leonard Cohen in her new novel. And we look at theatre now available to view online. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Set on the Greek island of Hydra in 1960, A Theatre for Dreamers is the new novel from Polly Sampson. The narrator is Erica, a young English woman who arrives on the island from dreary London, where the swinging 60s haven't yet happened. Erica has ambitions to write and gets involved with a group of artists there, some of whose names you may know very well. A young Leonard Cohen, for instance, and the Marianne of that famous song. Polly Sampson joins me now on the line from Sussex. Erica is a fictional character in this book of yours, Polly, but the community of artists quite definitely drawn from real life, with the couple Charmian Clift and George Johnson really at the centre of this grouping. Just remind us who they were and the kind of the couple that they were in the 1960s.
Oh yes, good evening. So Charmian Clift and George Johnson were Australian, and they were married writers who'd done an incredibly brave thing in the 50s when, if you think about it, you know, there was no EasyJet or any way of getting anywhere. They did this very brave thing of leaving Australia and deciding that they were going to just be writers and live on a Greek island. This is about the same time as the Durrells. In fact, Charmian's memoir of that time was published at the same time as Gerald Durrell's. It's during that same period as the Durrells. And they had two small children, and they decided really that they'd had enough of cities and city life. George Johnston had been a very famous war photographer, and they just did go and live on, first of all, an island called Kalymnos for a year, and then on Hydra, where there was no electricity, no running water. They, in fact, installed the first flushable lavatory on the whole island. And they made a life for themselves for a decade and lived from hand to mouth, really, from whatever they could get from royalties for their various books.
They're sometimes referred to as the...
Sorry.
They're sometimes referred to as the Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath of Australia. How tempestuous was the Clift Johnson relationship?
Oh, it was dreadful. They each had problems. George had a terrible childhood. You know, he'd been very, very badly abused by his father. Charmian, unbeknownst to anyone other than George, had become pregnant when she was 18 and had given the baby up for adoption, and so she had that sort of secret wound. And what didn't help was that George had seen terrible things in his war reporting days, terrible famines in China, lots of tragedy, and he had become an alcoholic. And really, in a way, it was the demon drink that was their enemy. And George had also contracted tuberculosis in the 40s in China, but was the symptoms had only just started sort of becoming a problem when they were living in Greece. And eventually he was diagnosed, but the drugs that he took for his TB made him impotent. And Charmian, at this point, who was 10 years younger than him, was, you know, beautiful, vivacious woman in her mid-30s. And a husband who was impotent, being on a Greek island, which was actually, had then become a magnet for all sorts of attractive young people who wanted to paint and write, it just set up a terrible problem for them with his jealousy and her, you know, problem of trying to keep her marriage going because she loved him very much, but at the same time, you know, unable to live like a nun.
To what extent then was it in fact that, you know, you've given us some very good reasons for their difficulties and some of their behaviours, but they're also within that mix is this idea of the artistic temperament and perhaps the temperament that's needed to write or to be an artist of any kind. To what extent, by bringing not just Clift and Johnson, but Leonard Cohen and Marianne Illen and several others into this island who were there in reality, to what extent were you looking at this idea of, you know, the claustrophobia that creates these type of tensions?
Yeah, well, it was a very, very interesting group of people. And I first came to them not with any deliberate thought, actually. I came to them through the writing of Charmian Clift and having visited Idra and read her memoir and then read some of her essays, because she went on in the 5 years that she lived in Australia after this 10 years in Greece. She wrote some amazing essays. And I really fell for her. And I was also, coincidentally, an enormous Leonard Cohen fan. And it was only when I started to think about, this, we're talking 6 years ago, writing this book, that I found a cache of photographs, of over 1,500 photographs taken by a photographer friend of George Johnston's, of that community, and put two and two together and realized that Leonard Cohen and Charmian Clift, you know, the two of my sort of most adored writers, had been there at the same time. And so it started with those two, with wanting to understand their relationship, really, because in the photographs you can see there's an enormous intimacy, and it's something that no one had ever really looked at before, because generally they didn't sort of ask who the other people in the photographs were. And so I started off by identifying all the other people who were there, which was good, took quite a long time. And then the thing about these people was so many of them were writers, and writers write, and so they all wrote about each other, or there were biographies written about them. And then I would go to the academic libraries and find their letters and their diaries, and it became quite a labyrinth of research. But once I'd got the idea of Erica, I started to sort of think about the questions I wanted to ask these people. And, you know, a lot of those questions were to do with the creative life, because they were all trying to write or paint or write songs or make beautiful things. And also the thing that really interested me was how the women found the time during that period. You know, we're talking 1960, the 60s haven't yet really begun, how they broke out of their roles as helpmeet and, you know, as Marianne is, you know, often thought of as a muse, and did their own work, which Charmian Clift did manage to do some of her own work, and very beautiful work it is too.
Certainly in the case of Charmian Clift, you give her several opportunities to refer to the fact that, you know, women on the island found themselves in roles, very traditional roles in some ways, and supporting their men, if you like, and being the muse for the great writer, while they, who were equally great writers and in some cases much better great writers, had to kind of put their work on the back boiler.
Yeah, it was such a moment of moment of change, really. There was this opportunity to look at that, because the photographs that I started with were taken at this moment where women's lives, particularly, were hanging in the brink, because we were still, in some ways, women were still living with the values of the 50s. And yet, the 60s was about to explode, and they were about to start questioning. And, we're between the first wave of feminism and the second wave of feminism. They were, they'd had Simone de Beauvoir, but they hadn't yet had Germaine Greer. And so it was a really interesting moment to look at, particularly women who wanted, in Charmian's case, to write, to look at how she might live her life and the struggle that she had, but then also to compare her to someone like Marianne Elon, who had been brought up in a very old-fashioned way by her grandmother, and who had first of all been married to one writer called Axel Jensen, a rather brilliant young writer, not a very nice man, I suspect, but he was the sort of Jack Kerouac of Norway, wildly successful. And then when he had sort of run off and left her, very, very soon after that, she met Leonard Cohen, and again fell into that role of, as Leonard Cohen always sort of said of her, it was a sort of wonderful thing. On his desk every day was a gardenia and a little sandwich. And so I have told this story through the eyes of an 18-year-old who, again, is on the brink of adulthood and is looking for both role models and anti-role models. And when she goes to Idra, she has this opportunity to look at Charmian Clift, on the one hand, struggling to be, an artist in her own right, and Marianne with a very different sort of struggle, despite the fact that she doesn't particularly have a thing that she wants to do herself, but it's still a terribly compromising position to be the person at home with the baby, you know, putting the gardenia on someone else's desk. And those two women, really, you know, studying them and finding out everything I could about them and then turning them into fictional characters, it was such a wonderful way to look at women's choices, which you know, in many ways are the same today. I mean, things have improved, but they're not 100% yet.
The other thing is you mentioned there in terms of Axel Jensen, who was the partner of Marianne Illen, and he, you say he was a brilliant writer, but a not very nice man.
Yeah.
In fact, you could say of many of the artists on this island,
yeah,
some of them are quite brilliant and not very nice people. And to be fair to you, you're not you don't keep all the nasties in one gender. Men and yeah, women can be both brilliant and nasty,
yeah,
in this. How important is that tension, do you think, or was it perhaps then for the creation, the creativity of these people?
I think it was, on the whole, very unhelpful. I think that if any of them could have had a more peaceful life, they would have possibly been more productive. I think far too much of their time was spent in conflict, and particularly in drunken conflict with their partners. And I think that was because so much was being fought for, you know, because it was incredibly hard work to live on this island, because, you know, no running water. It's an island of steps. There are no cars, not even bicycles. But, you know, the streets are precipitous. You know, somebody was having to go and get water from the well and bring it to the house, up, you know, in some cases, hundreds of steps. All food had to be sort of found on the dock and taken up again up these hills to the houses. So there was, you know, actually just living. It was like being in the Middle Ages. And so although it was very beautiful and the sun shone, and you think, you know, when we look at these photographs, some of them are quite famous, these photographs, like the ones of Leonard Cohen playing his guitar under the tree and everyone looking so relaxed, it wasn't a very relaxed way of living. And it's also a tiny island, and, you know, it's sort of 5 miles wide, and it's got one part of it, tiny part, tiny town that is habitable. And all of these people thrown into one place and seeing each other over and over and over again, you know, you would just see the same people every day and every evening. If you went down to the port, you know, there would be the same faces getting drunk. I think in some ways that created tension, and sexual tension and drunken tension and just, you know, sort of bored tension that was possibly really unhelpful for people's work. And, you know, often their great work was done not on the island. I think it, you know, all the, and also because they had to produce things. In George Johnston's case, in order to live that life, he had to write, as well as trying to write his more literary works, he had to write and publish a potboiler every year just to keep food on the table. So I think it was a very hard life, and I think in many ways it wasn't particularly helpful to be spending so much time sort of in this cauldron of people bickering.
I'm often quite envious, and in some ways I admire the audacity of a writer to choose a Greek island like Hydra as the location for her new novel, because of course you would have to visit and you would have
it
to
was
research.
Dreadful.
Very difficult. How different a place was the Greek island that you visited, I presume, in the past decade, let us say. Maybe you've been visiting it for longer, yeah, than that. But the island that you visited in terms of the research for the novel, how different a place was it from the island of 1960, which you as you describe, yeah, it, is kind of both this rural idyll and this medieval backwater.
Yeah, well, interestingly, it can't change very much because they can't put in roads for the reasons I've said, because it's, you know, it's mountainous and there's just this one tiny port and everything else is steps. There's, even to this day, there is limited electricity. I mean, I've been on the island, you know, where for 4 days there was no electricity. It's governed by, you know, all sorts of winds that mean that sometimes you can't rely on getting on or off the island. And the other thing about it is it's a national monument. So there can be no new building. You can only rebuild ruins. There are no high-rise buildings. There are no big hotels. It feels to me, and certainly people who, you know, who are older than me, who've been there for a very long time, say that it really hasn't changed very much at all. And the other thing that is certainly true is that it you know, you still have to lug your shopping up those hills if you're staying there. And you do see the same people day in, day out, and you do sit in the same sort of, you know, half a dozen places that you can sit off season, and you see the same people, and you definitely I went in every month because I wanted to be able to write about the changing seasons, and you definitely get this sense that you are seeing the same people over and over again, and which is both wonderful, you know, it actually on the whole wonderful, but if it was year in year out, and you were, you know, having to get so involved with their personal lives, it might get to be a problem. I could absolutely see how that would happen today.
I don't think you will get much sympathy on many of those worries, Polly, somehow or other.
But congratulations.
I can hear you're not. Congratulations on the novel.
Polly
Sanson speaking to us about her current publication, A Theatre of Dreamers, which is published by Bloomsbury Circus. Well, we did mention Leonard Cohen. We did mention Marianne Illan. So there's really only one song we can play.
I never said that I was brave. Oh, so long, Marianne.
And just coming up to 27 minutes past 7 on Tuesday night's Arena. The current COVID-19 virus, of course, means that all of our theatres have had to close, causing so much live performance to be cancelled and so many of our colleagues in the theatre world to be out of work. But mindful of the need to keep the art form alive, even while the doors are closed, many theatres are offering a number of online options to the theatre lover. Helen Meaney has been looking at some of those currently available, and she joins me now. To a large extent, I think you're going to talk to us tonight, Helen, about archive material that many theatres have now put up online for us. Is there a lot of it out there?
Oh, there's absolutely loads. Yeah, lots of choice. So some of the major theatres have been just digging into their archives of things that they had already filmed, and they're releasing them for us to watch at home, which is brilliant. And also, most of it, or a lot of it, is free. So, and then as the weeks go by, I think more and more companies are doing that, so that you know, there's so many options to choose from, which is really good. Including fans of Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Fleabag will be very pleased to know that that is already up online for about 3 weeks from Soho Theatre's website, and that's going to be, I think it's €4.50, and which is all going to go to charity to support theatre workers in the arts during this COVID-19 crisis.
It's important there, I suppose, Helen, to remember in the case of Fleabag, because people might say, well, sure, we've been looking at that on Netflix for ages, but this is not the Netflix or the TV series Fleabag. This is the original stage show. So you really get to see
this
character.
This is a theatre piece which spawned all the other things. So, you know, and then it went on. Of course, it took on a life of its own in a TV series, and then it won loads of awards. And it's been streamed in cinemas, you know, so some people might have been lucky enough to see it if you're living in you know, Dublin, Galway or Cork. But for the rest of us, it's a chance to see her on stage in a show that started in, you know, as a tiny fringe show. She's raising money for charity while she does it. So that's impressive.
And the important thing that you've pointed out, just let me say, the important thing that you've pointed out there, Helen, is that these are pieces of theatre that in the olden days there was one camera at the back of the theatre and something was taped for archive purely as a record, but you couldn't watch it. It was so static and so stuck in its way, you know, because it was a single
basic
camera, no movement.
Yeah.
Whereas now with the National Theatre Live and with lots of theatres in the West End sending their stuff out to cinemas worldwide, it's a totally different style that you're getting. It's something that you can really watch. It's not. It's a real experience.
It is. And it, I mean, it's still evolving, I think, you know. And it was actually the operas that began, the Met and the Royal Opera House, and that, which began with, you know, with very static cameras. But now, we've, as many of us will have seen National Theatre live broadcast in cinema, it's become much more sophisticated in terms of, it's almost, it's another art form, actually, filming the live performance for it to be, for it to be then streamed.
A lot of Shakespeare available, I believe.
There is a lot of Shakespeare. And the free, well, actually, the marquee website called marqueetv.com is offering, during this time, to support all of us stuck at home, is offering a free trial. And it has, that's where you would go to see a lot of the Royal Shakespeare Company, or a see also a ballet, but particularly loads of RSC productions. The one I particularly was struck by was Simon Russell Beale in The Tempest from Stratford-on-Avon in 2016. And it's just quite a treat to see that.
Well, let's listen to a clip from that. In fact, the Royal Shakespeare Company's version of The Tempest. Simon Russell Beale as Prospero, Mark Quarterly as the character of Ariel.
Come away, servant. Come. I'm ready now. Approach my Ariel. Come.
All hail, great master, grave sir, hail. I come to answer thy best pleasure, be it to fly, to swim, to dive into the fire, to ride on the curled clouds, to thy strong bidding task, Ariel, and all his qualities.
Hast thou spirit performed to point the tempest that I bade thee?
To every article. I boarded the king's ship. Now on the beak, now in the waist, the deck, in every cabin, I flamed amazement. Sometime I divide and burn in many places. On the topmast, the yards and bowsprit, would I flame distinctly, then meet and join. Jove's lightning, the precursors of the dreadful thunderclaps, more momentary in sight outrunning were not. The fire and cracks of sulphurous roaring, the most mighty Neptune seemed to besiege and make his bold waves tremble, yea, his dread trident shake.
My brave spirit, who was so firm, so constant, that this coil would not infect his reason.
Not a soul but felt a fever of the mad, and played some tricks of desperation. All but
And that was Simon Russell Beale there as Prospero, Mark Quarterly as Ariel in the Royal Shakespeare Company's production of The Tempest. And that one of the online offerings that Helen Meaney is telling us about this evening. You mentioned, Helen, that some things are looking for payment, some things are free. And in the case of The Globe, again, great home of the plays of Shakespeare in the very centre of London, you get a real authentic feel of the experience here if you're lucky enough to go to The Globe live. They have a lot of Shakespeare, and it's totally free.
Yeah, I mean, they had until very recently a subscription arrangement, but now, just again during this period, they're putting up six major productions, which you just go to their website and you can just start playing through YouTube, and it's for, you know, all, there's no time limit on it. You can any time of the day or night. So for Shakespeare lovers, it's a treat. Also for students, I mean, I think that's invaluable. The Globe is always focusing on trying to create an authentic Elizabethan experience. So they're quite purist about the setting, about candlelight. And there was a big controversy not so long ago about introducing, you know, effects that were not in the period. But it's, you know, it's a great experience. It's in the round, and you're standing, you can stand as a sort of groundling, as if you were there in, you know, at a Shakespeare performance, and there's a great sense of atmosphere, which we can now see from basically our sofas. So I would recommend having a good browse on that website, and it's all, as I say, it's all free.
Specific plays that they have coming up. The Hamlet is on the way. It started yesterday, did it?
Yes, yeah, well, it's sort of all the classics, really. But the Simon Russell Beale, which we were just hearing there, I would highly recommend that. I mean, that is for people who may have seen Simon Russell Beale when he came to Dublin, and I thought his Hamlet was extraordinary, but the Prospero that we just heard, it's just a really complex, yeah, and sort of vulnerable portrayal.
Let's move on to
Prospero,
something a little.
And I never.
Let's move on to something a little bit closer to home. You have some recommendations specifically. Again, this I suppose is for younger listeners and their parents.
No, I we're talking about The Haircut, which is,
yes, I am, yes,
at the Arc. Yes, yes. This is a really lovely, charming show. It's for, well, I would say it's for children and adults, and perfect for if both are together, as we all are in one place at the moment. It's on online at the Arc, on the Arc's at home. Basically, go to the Arc's website, thearc.ie, and then into their live performances section. And it was staged during Dublin Theatre Festival last October. It's written and directed by Wayne Jordan and composed by Tom Lane. It's an adaptation of the legend of Laura Linshuk, the Irish folktale of the king who had the ears of a donkey, but it's set in contemporary Ireland. And you know, there's a young Dublin kid played by Thomas Cane Byrne called Kwame, and he is, for complicated reasons, he's the one who's chosen to cut the king's hair, and then the story was that once the person, the barber who cuts the king's hair, then has to be killed so that he doesn't pass on the secret that the king has as the ears of an ass. So it's all done with beautiful live musicians on stage, a lot of percussion and cello, and it's was designed by, costume and set by Sarah Bacon, and it's absolutely lovely. It's a fable, really. It's about sort of a celebration of the imagination and being and creativity, as opposed to the king's regime, which is all about control and coercion and a kind of and joylessness. So it's actually a lovely show, and it's only on until tomorrow, I think. Yeah, tomorrow. Yeah. And then the Arc will then put up another show, which I think starting on Thursday will be a play by Kate Heffernan called Pete. So again, it's, you need to keep checking in with their website, because they're adding more and more performances once from every Thursday.
Well, let's have a listen to Thomas Cane Byrne then. You have just tonight and tomorrow to go and watch this. And if you're watching with younger listeners, I suppose it's probably tomorrow that you'll be going to listen to and see The Haircut with Thomas Cane Byrne. And this is Thomas Cane Byrne playing the character of Kwame.
The king lived in a castle at the centre of the city in the middle of the country. And that country was an island in the middle of the sea. His castle was a concrete box with no windows and one secret door, and he insisted that everything turn inwards and nothing ever change. His father had been the king, and his father before him, and his father, they had always been the man in charge, the head and the crown, and the arse on the throne. The kingdom wasn't a happy place. It was busy and loud in places like a headache, and quiet and cold in others. The Linshuks had ruled for hundreds of years, and they had drained the colour out of the landscape and the people. There were stories, ancient tales about bird song and butterflies, and people having time to read in their flower gardens and owning their own homes. But nobody really believed in those. They were only stories to help children sleep. And no one remembered about things like music for dancing or being friendly in the street. They just got on with things. Life in the shadow of the Linshuk Castle was tough and cloudy. But you know, the trains ran on time. The king's name was Linshuk. Lowry Linshuk. And Lowry Linshuk was the High King of Ireland.
And that's Thomas Kane Byrne there in a clip from The Haircut, which is available on the ARC's website. Available there until tomorrow night, arc.ie. And then on Thursday, as Helen Meaney has been telling us, things will change over. Druid also are putting out one of their part of their Sing season out for free, Helen?
Yes, that's right. So it's do you remember they in back in 2005, I can't believe it's 15 years ago, Druid Sing was in all of the works of J.M. Sing done in rep, and it was a remarkable kind of achievement, and using the same, you know, the same ensemble, which I suppose became what is now the Druid Ensemble. But this was the Playboy, which was part of that whole enterprise, and this was directed by Gary Hines with Aaron Monaghan and Catherine Walsh as Christy Mahon and Peggy Mike. And it's a lovely, I was looking at it again yesterday, and it's really stood up well. It's incredibly fresh. There's a real sense of the tragedy and the comedy well balanced, and I think the casting of the two works really very well.
And the Taoiseach has been saying that by hook or by crook, the Leaving Cert will go ahead. So the Playboy of the Western World available in that Druid production would be useful for students trying to study forward to that.
Yeah, it's on the Leaving Cert curriculum. So, yeah, I think. But it's actually a really nice production. It's very well filmed. This is one that was filmed by a film company called Wildfire Films. And actually, 2005... The complexity of filming it, live production, so you're not getting too many close-ups of, you know, stage makeup and all of that, getting the right angles. I think they did it really well. There's a lot of movement, and it's very fluid camera work. So it's actually really enjoyable to watch. And of course, the two actors are fantastic.
Yeah, druid.ie, Catherine Walsh and Aaron Monaghan playing Peggy and Mike and the Playboy respectively. Finally, just staying in Galway to finish up, an unrelated matter in some ways, but very sad news. Difficult enough with the COVID-19 crisis that we have no theatre, but Galway 2020 really has, it just seems to have been dogged with difficulties from the very start, and reduced version announced again today. Helen Marge, the artistic director, and her company Artichoke are no longer involved, Helen.
Yeah, I mean, it's just been so disappointing for Galway. I mean, all of the you know, 2.5 years of work, all of the communities and all of the people involved, all of the arts professionals. It's of course, you know, totally understandable decision, but how devastating. You know, it's just, I'm very sorry to hear that. And I was there for the opening weekend, which of course the opening ceremony had to be abandoned because of Storm Ciara. So it just seems that Galway 2020 has really been battered on a number of fronts. And, you know, of course it's worrying for everyone involved, but you know, the teams of designers, choreographers, production managers. I mean, it's a terribly sad day, I think.
Yeah, it is. It is a very sad day indeed. It just seems to have been dogged with trouble, as you say, from the very start. That's Helen Meaney speaking to us there latterly about Galway 2020, and before that, some of the online offerings of the theatre that are available to us at the moment. Well, right now, let's have a rummage through the arts and culture archives. Maybe this enforced slowdown of life is giving you increased reading time. Perhaps with that increased reading time, the work of John Banville is crossing your literary desk. Well, don't forget there's more to John Banville than just John Banville. There's his crime writing alter ego, Benjamin Black, or more recently, B.W. Black. In 2013, John Banville spoke to Sinead Egan about what it's like to have two very separate literary identities.
There are no Hercule Poirot's, there are no Sherlock Holmes's. And that's how things are. And, you know, most crimes don't get solved. Those that do get solved, you know, very little justice is meted out. This is life. And when I started writing these quirk books, that was a pact I made with myself, that I would make them as, if not as realistic as possible, then as plausible as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the essence of noir fiction, because it's all about secrets. The criminal has a secret, of course, but usually all the people around the criminal have secrets as well, as we all have. Crime fiction is driven by plot, character, dialogue. These are things that Batman doesn't care about at all. Real crime writers get furious when I say things like this, but this is just how it is. Van von Black are completely different writers. One is not necessarily better than the other, or worse than the other. They're just entirely different. You can't compare them. It's apples and oranges. Benjamin Black is quite humble. He has no pretensions. And he rather despises Banville for his pretensions. I look on the Quirk books as well-made, well-carpentered. I want them to be, you know, like a well-made piece of furniture, beautifully constructed, beautifully polished. And I'm quite proud of them. I'm not proud of the Banville books because they're all such abject failures. But the Quirk books, I do feel it, I do take pride in.
Afterwards, Quirk had tried to put it all back together in his mind like a jigsaw puzzle. It would never be complete. The bits he remembered most clearly were the least significant, such as the smell of the drenched laurel behind the railings in the square, a street lamp's rain-pocked reflection in a puddle, the cold, greasy feel of the area steps under his desperately scrambling fingers. There was throughout a sense of deep embarrassment. That must have been the reason he did not cry out for help. Embarrassment and a kind of incredulity. Such things did not happen. Yet this one did. And he had the wounds to prove it.
I don't think he's a very admirable character. He's certainly not a very nice character, but he is interesting. I have a certain sympathy for him. He is driven by the darkness in his own past. He's an orphan. He doesn't know where he came from, although he has some troubling suspicions as to what his origins might be. And this, I think, is what drives him. This hunger to know people's secrets, to know where people come from, what they've done in the past. And he has his own, if not crimes, certainly very serious misdemeanors in his own past. I'd put it this way, he's not morally admirable, but I think that he is, in a curious way, spiritually admirable. There's no point in going to what's now called literary fiction, because literary fiction is always about the past. In crime fiction, I suppose you could write about the present. Maybe my black books, even though they're set in the 1950s, maybe they are, almost accidentally as it were, maybe they are some kind of commentary on present-day realities of Irish life. They're telling us very dark things. Literary Ireland has produced giants or failures. We seem to have no middle ground. We seem to have no middle brow tradition. We aim to be the greatest or nothing. And I suspect that crime writing was part of that. You know, we were sort of too good for it. You know, I want to be James Joyce. I want to be Oscar Wilde. I want to be William Butler Yeats. I don't want to be Dorothy L. Sayers.
Twenty years ago, a television sitcom hit the screens, which was to leave a lasting impact on its devoted fan base. Gilmore Girls focused principally on the relationship between a lone parent, Lorelai Gilmore, her daughter, Rory, and their life in the small town of Stars Hollow in Connecticut. The series also kick-started the careers of future Oscar nominee and Bridesmaid star Melissa McCarthy and Alexis Bledel, now equally well known for her role in The Handmaid's Tale. Jennifer Gannon has been looking at the enduring appeal of Gilmore Girls girls, and she joins me now on the line. I have not heard mashed potatoes used as a description of a television programme before, Jennifer, but that is how you describe Gilmore Girls, in a very positive way, I believe.
Yeah, 100%. There is something about Gilmore Girls that, for me, it's a very relaxing, very calm and watch. And I can, it's true escapism. I can totally understand why people are turning to it right now at this very moment. It's like visual hot chocolate. It's gentle. It's sweet. Nothing extremely awful happens. And if anything remotely upsetting happens, it's all resolved within 40 minutes. So it's predictable, low stakes, easy watch. And that's why I think it's like the gorgeous comfort and mashed potatoes of telly.
Okay, fair enough. And I like that description. We're talking about, essentially, we've three generations of women, but it focuses really on the mother-daughter relationship between Lorelai and Rory, which is a girl's name in this particular case.
Yeah, there's, you know, two Lorelais, so that's why the nickname is Rory is given to the daughter, because they're both Lorelai. But it's a show that's firmly centred on the bonds of family, but especially the unique relationships between women, so between mothers and daughters. And Lorelai and Rory are like best friends, because, you know, Lorelai had Rory when she was 16. And then there's the addition of the matriarch of the Gilmore family, Emily Gilmore. She's the grandmother, and it's about the relationship she's trying to have now with Rory. But the women really took centre stage, and it's about the intricacies and difficulties of these relationships. That was the basis of the show. So rather than your kind of run-of-the-mill boy meets girl sitcom, this was a very different central focus.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip that features mother, daughter and grandmother, if you like, in the midst of all of this. Lauren Graham plays Lorelai. Alexis Bledel is the younger Lorelai, or Rory. And that matriarch, Emily, is played by Kelly Bishop. They're all sitting at the dinner table waiting for dad, or granddad, as it, whichever you want it to be, Richard Gilmore, to arrive back, played by Edward Herrmann. But it's the three women that we hear speaking, first of all.
Mom?
No.
We're starving.
We're waiting for your father.
It's gonna get cold.
We are waiting for your father.
We've been waiting forever.
We have not been waiting forever.
Forever? Godot was just here. He said, I ain't waiting for Richard. Grabbed a roll and left. It's been forever.
When we gather as a family, we eat as a family. We don't eat in shifts. You know that, and Richard certainly knows that.
When did he get that antique car anyhow?
A couple of horrible weeks ago.
What happened to the oil painting hobby of his?
Well, you know your father. When he couldn't foresee rivaling Cezanne, he lost interest, so he bought that car. Lorelai!
Mom, it's not dinner. It's just my private stash.
It's eating, and we're not eating.
You know, you're bound by the rules of the Geneva Convention, Mother, just like everyone else. Hey, no one told me it was casual Friday.
Hello, everyone. You haven't started?
Of course we haven't started. We were waiting for you. I thought you were almost done.
Well, I was, but this car has a mind of its own. As I turned to leave, it began spraying some sort of green solution at me.
Yuck.
Yuck, indeed. Well, go on, start. No sense in waiting for me.
Coolness.
Stop.
Gomer said.
We are waiting for you, Richard. In 35 years, I have never, ever started a dinner without you unless you were out of town or seriously ill. Elsa, take everything away and keep it warm. Now, please go upstairs and get ready so we can all enjoy a nice family dinner together.
I'll be right back.
And that's Edward Herrmann as Richard just at the end of that clip. And before that, you heard Kelly Bishop as the matriarch of the family, Alexis Bledel as the young Rory, and Lauren Graham as Lorelai, who was starving at the table. And who, in the midst of all of that, Jennifer Gannon manages to get a reference into Beckett, albeit that she's waiting for Godot rather than Godot, as we might say in this neck of the woods. But what kind of references were there? I mean, was it that high flown all the time, or did it have popular culture references in it as well?
It was always like that. There is like an extremely old-fashioned classic Hollywood sensibility in its writing. Like the showrunner, Amy Sherman-Palladino, she was known for creating this series where the main character spoke faster than Rosalind Russell in His Girl Friday. And it really was the audience's job to keep up. And they used the tagline, life is short, talk fast. And the scripts for TV are usually only about 30 to 40 pages long, but the scripts for Gilmore Girls rolled in at about 80 pages long. So I think with the show itself, it really didn't speak down to its audience or treat them with contempt, which a lot of teen shows would have done at the time. But the Gilmore Girl fans were sent down a rabbit hole of pop culture. All the characters had these obsessive knowledge in their areas of interest, from movies, TV, junk food, literature, politics and history. So they referenced in every episode, they referenced everything from the Manson family to Grey Gardens to Beckett, as we heard, or even The Godfather. They never dumbed anything down. And when you look at it, there is 339 book titles mentioned in about 152 episodes. on the show. Wow. And apparently Rory has supposed to have read most of them. And you can find that book list online if you're so inclined.
Yeah, Rory is quite a clever young woman, it has to be said. Or do we call her, is she still a young girl, really, when we're watching her in Gilmore Girls? Let's listen to her in conversation with her mother this time. And it's the nature of their relationship. And they're on phone lines, I should say, in this clip, in opposite rooms, so they can't see each other, which is part of the fun of the way the mother and daughter speak.
Hello?
We have an email relationship.
Hi.
Oh. She speaks. She has the ability.
What's wrong?
What? Are you okay? Are you sick?
I'm getting over a cold. You knew that.
No, I didn't. Because our once wonderful relationship, envy of all the world, more intimate than that of the naked couple in the Love Is cartoons, has degenerated into email correspondence.
I'm sure I wrote that I had a cold.
No, you didn't.
In all those emails, I didn't mention it?
All those emails? I'm sorry, but you write less than the people offering to enlarge a piece of anatomy I do not possess.
I could have sworn I told you.
I just reread every email you sent in the past 10 days. No sickness mentioned, but you did share these gems. Hey, what up? Is it freezing there too? Ice. And who pooped. And then you added one of those obnoxious hieroglyphics that I can never read. They're supposed to indicate you're laughing or smiling or frowning or vomiting. I don't know what.
That's a typo. I don't do cutesy symbols.
You're not even using verbs. That's not a relationship. Relationships need verbs.
Well, yours aren't much better.
I'm not saying they are.
I can never get you on the phone.
Oh, I can never get you.
You got me now?
Freak of nature. What do you look like? Do you look the same?
Hold on, my nose ring is itching.
Don't kid. I'm mad and needy.
Well, meet me at the inn, 10 o'clock.
Oh, but it's been so long. How will we recognize each other?
We'll wear a rose in our lapels.
Or dangling from my nose ring.
You're kidding about that, right?
I don't know if I want a daughter like that. Lauren Graham as Lorelei and Alexis Patel as her daughter, Rory. She really is, she's as smart as the mum.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And the thing about the show itself is that lovers of Gilmore Girls have a strange relationship with it. There's a lot of cognitive dissonance involved in being a Gilmore's fan. I mean, everyone I know that loves the show also dislikes it the exact same amount. Mm. Like Sex and the City, it's a show where the main characters can be unbelievably irritating to the point of infuriating. Like, both Lorelai and Rory are extremely entitled and very privileged. They're never far away from a cotillion or a conversation about a trust fund. Yeah. And money seems to flow around their lives like a sustained reservoir, so that can be hard to get a grip on. But there's something else to it that it really does. It wraps up nicely in the end, so you can't get too annoyed with them. That's the main thing.
Yeah, but Palladino did, or Sherman Palladino did revisit it recently. What was the revamp, and what was the attitude of long-term fans or long-time fans to that revamp?
Yeah, Amy Sherman-Palladino, she left the show before its final season due to creative problems with the CW network. And the fans didn't agree with the final season. So she never really got her say, because the series then became more focused on conventional relationships and the pacing was a lot slower. So then we were all really excited when she signed up with Netflix in 2016 to give us a Gilmore Girls A Year in a Life, which was returned to Stars Hollow to see how things turned out. But it didn't really live up to the spirit of the original, and it has a very controversial ending that Palladino had apparently been planning since the first season, and it felt very out of context and it left a sour taste in a lot of fans' mouths. So I like to imagine that it never really happened and they just leave it as it was.
Right, so don't watch that one. Go back to the original set of 7 seasons, Jennifer Gannon suggesting there, for Gilmore Girls. And all 7 seasons are now available on Netflix, and that is our lot for this evening. Now, if you want to get tonight's programme on podcast, it'll be available from tomorrow afternoon. And in fact, you can listen back to past episodes on rte.ie/radio1/arena. But that's our lot for tonight. Paula Shields researched, Jimmy Doyle was in sound, Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.